was announced over the weekend that the Donegal Person of the Year, the recipient this year, is collectively the people of Chrysler. Elaine Caffrey is president of the Donegal Association in Dublin and joins us now. Elaine, thank you very much for taking the call. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Right, okay. Now, I think this is great. I think this is really fitting. Talk to us about the how we came to this point.
Yeah, no problem. Well, I suppose Friday the 7th of October was the day that Donegal just came to a standstill that afternoon when the news hit of the terrible tragedy that occurred in Chrysler. But it was also the day that the Chrysler community went into rallying and support mode for their own people. And it was just incredible how everybody came together. That was people at the scene of the tragedy, including the emergency services, the civil service and the voluntary sector, ambulance crews, Gardaí, fire brigade, obviously the local clergy, the undertakers had a huge part to play in the days following that tragedy. The local business owners, how they came together, people offering food to customers that were coming in that they weren't even customers, there were people in the area just supporting the local people, doing what they could. There were people assisting the scene all through the day, all through the night and the following day, some of them using machinery, some of them using their own bare hands to just try to help the victims of this tragedy. Later on in the days and weeks that followed, then the community rallied around to get vital services up and running again in the local area. The local and national media who were on the scene had never seen anything like it. They had said, the international media had never seen anything like this. They remarked on the people of Chrysler, how they were offering tea and sustenance to those people covering the events and everything. And it was just really, really remarkable how the entire community just came together, supported each other through their own grief, their shock and their pain. But it was just astounding, and we had to mark this. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, so, and as you say, a lot of it, the memories come back, how the local coffee shop, how they just kicked in. And then, you know, managing young people as well. Do you know what I mean? Those that are working with the young people involved in sport and having to crack on in certain areas for the benefit of the children, even though maybe when they weren't in necessarily in the space themselves to do it. It's a catch-all then, the people of Chrysler. It is the people of Chrysler as well. But it's all of those people that you mentioned, all of those that were there, that were affected by it, not necessarily from Chrysler, but were involved in that. Is that the people of Chrysler catching all of those people and recognising their efforts, Elaine?
Exactly. It's recognising everybody's efforts. And obviously not just during the tragedy and the cleanup and helping with the victims and the victims' families, but it's since then. It's the rebuild of Chrysler. It's helping the people of Chrysler come through this. There's still an awful lot of work being undertaken in the area, and it's recognising all of that effort as a collective, you know.
Of course, instantly, and quite rightly so, Father John Joe was everyone's pick for this, but I don't think his modesty would have allowed him to accept this as an individual, even if it were on behalf of everyone. But I just think it's important, Elaine, if you share with me in this, in that if it was about a person, Father John Joe would have been in the stratosphere in terms of the popular vote.
Yeah, well, I mean, normally we can't really comment on individuals that have been nominated for Donegal Person of the Year for obvious reasons. You know, there's always more than one individual nominated, and it just wouldn't be fair. And you have to respect people's privacy in that matter as well. But in this circumstance, because of the individual involved, we can confirm that there were a huge and unprecedented amount of nominations for that individual, and rightly so, and very, very justified for the efforts that were involved at that time. However, having spoken to him, he would not feel it right to accept a reward for work that he would have preferred not to have had to be done, and that he was just doing his duty.
Yes, of course. That's a testimony to him and his character, and it all makes perfect sense. And I wasn't aware of that, and I hope I didn't drag that out of you, Elaine, but I know for a fact that that's who everyone wanted to recognise. But I also know that he wouldn't allow it to be about him either. But I think we all know. But I think now the way it's panned out, too, it's perfect as well, if that makes sense.
it's rewarding everybody involved, and that includes the man himself, but it also includes everybody else that really came together, and they really were remarkable. I mean, people are still talking about it, and they will continue talking to, we'll continue talking about this in our lifetime. You know, this will never be forgotten. And it's not just the disaster and how tragic it was, and the shock and pain and grief that, that hit the county, but it really is the effort that went in afterwards and still continues to go in to just bringing the community together.
And it is interesting in that the association, the Donegal Association in Dublin, it was founded in the wake of a tragedy itself.
We were founded in 1935 as a result of the Iron Moor disaster, where 20 people lost their lives, and it was very tragic in those times, in that the majority of the people who lost their lives were the breadwinners of the families on Iron Moor Island. So it really was a massive disaster for that area. So a group of people who were living in Dublin from Donegal came together, founded the association, and started fundraising to support the people affected on Iron Moor. And that's really where our association is born. That's where our roots are, and that's where we continue to focus on it. It's, we want to promote Donegal in every which way we can, and that includes trying to raise awareness for different causes that have to be that deserve to, a recognition and deserve a platform. But also we like to recognise and raise awareness for the individuals that do the great work in Donegal to promote the county. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's where Donegal Person of the Year comes in. And in this year, it's Donegal Persons of the Year. It is the community.
And it keeps the flag flying in Dublin and further afield, the Donegal flag as well. Because of the way things were, Noel Cunningham has been the longest reigning Donegal Person of the Year. And he has used that in a really positive way for the county. In a way, I'm not really sure it could have fell into anyone else's hands, you know, the way he had to be the steward of it for longer than perhaps would have ordinarily happened. But it worked out. You had the perfect candidate there, and he has used it as an amazing platform to promote the county.
He has, and he has been an absolutely fantastic person of the year. And it was so timely the way his reign sort of fell during COVID as well, because obviously the tourism sector had a bit of a halt at that stage, and he was perfectly placed with his background in tourism as well and his experience to sort of kickstart that tourism again in Donegal and to use his platform to promote Donegal. And he really was the ideal and perfect candidate. We can't commend Noel enough for everything that he's done for Donegal over the years.
For sure. Right. Now, the event takes place in Dublin, doesn't it? Talk to us about that. Are tickets still available? It is on the 15th, isn't it?
15th of April, yeah. Tickets are available on our website, donegalassociation.ie, or by contacting any committee member. I think we have sent on the details to yourselves as well, so if you could, or I think you might have already shared it online. Mm-hmm. But we've issued the press releases. It's in the local papers. It's donegalassociation.ie the tickets are available from, and we'd love to see everyone there.
And I believe there's accommodation offer as well too, so get in early, I would suggest.
There is an accommodation offer, yeah. It's in the Bonington, Dublin, so there is accommodation. The special rate there is €140 for two persons' bed and breakfast and €120 for a single bed and breakfast, and use the code that was published as well. But if you call the Bonington and advise them that you're attending the event, they'll be able to reserve the room at that rate for you.
Okay, Elaine, well done to you and the committee. And as I say, it is lovely, I think, to be able to recognise the people of Crieslea. You've put it perfectly yourself. I can't add anything to that. And I'm sure it'll all be very well reflected on the night as well. Thank you, Elaine.
Thanks very much, Greg. Thank you.
Take care of yourself. All right, Elaine Caffrey there, who is president of the Donegal Association. Right, okay, I just want to let you know that the Highland Fling, you might be aware, is taking place in Glasgow from the 1st to the 4th of May. We are putting on a package for you to bring you over there in luxury coach transport, which is last on the list here, but I actually think that's quite important. Beautiful coaches we've got lined up for you. And we have accommodation in the 4-star Crown Plaza Hotel. Your breakfasts and your dinner are included, and then there's a ton of entertainment. On May the 1st, David James and the Ryan Turner Band. Declan Ernie's playing on May 2nd with brilliant guests as well. We'll go into the guests in a bit more detail down the line. On May the 3rd, Robert Mazzell is playing. So we take you over there, return journey on the ferry. You don't have to get on a plane. You're on a luxury coach, of course. You're staying in that four-star accommodation. Your breakfast and your dinner is sorted. Your bed is sorted. Your entertainment is sorted. And there's great cracker in and around the hotel too, in the bar and all that kind of stuff over the course of those number of days. Now, the reason I want to mention this again is that we're taking six coaches and we're on the fourth coach now. There's been a huge demand for this. And you can book your seat now for £100 per person. And then you can pay into it as you go, right? If you want to do it that way. Because it's not inconsiderable. It's £575 per person sharing. But when you consider what you're getting for that, the fact that you're getting out to go over to Scotland, you'll be able to go and visit Glasgow in your downtime if you wish. That's what you can do during the day. If you've got friends in Scotland, we have tickets available for the entertainment at night so they can call over and spend the night with you, enjoying the music at the Crown Plaza Hotel. If you want to reserve your seat right now, okay, for you and a loved one, maybe it's going to be your, what's that thing happens on February 14th? Valentine's Day. Maybe it's going to be your Valentine's present for someone. Why not be in their good books? I guarantee you they'll be delighted. Get in touch with us now for any questions, by the way. 07491 25000, 07491 25000. But seats, as you can imagine, I wouldn't mislead you. We're on our fourth, well into our fourth coach of six now. So it is going to sell out, and I don't want you to miss out. So if you have the 100 now, get your seat booked, and then you can pay in as you see fit then between now and close to the departure date. All right, so we want as many of you to come as possible. Of course, we're going to fill the coaches. It's going to be great fun. I am so envious of all of you heading over there. I really am. I'd love to go. I'd definitely try and get the money together if I were not working. Okay, we're joined on the programme now by Esther and Louise. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
It's good to have both of you with us. Esther, may I start with you just before we get into the reasons as to why we've invited you on the programme. Can you talk to me, I know we've spoken before, but just give listeners a brief outline of how you've been affected by the mother and baby home scandal.
Well, it's a huge disappointment. I can't believe this is happening in this day and age. And I guess what's sticking for me at this point in my life is Roderick O'Gorman and his government there, the government, are claiming that a baby can't feel anything from 0 to 6 months, nor does it remember anything from 0 to 6 months. So they're excluded from the redress scheme. I'm one of the youngest mothers that's or survivors from this. So a lot of us have passed in the last 8 years. And Holly Cairn said in the Dáil on St. Bridget's Day, you know, you're waiting for us to be worn down. And I was at that stage where I was worn down. I was giving up. I'm like, okay, I'm done with this. And when she said that, I thought, yeah. And she said, you know what? You won. That you got what you wanted, Mr. O'Gorman. You wore us down. So that kind of put some fight back in me. And mainly, I'd like Louise's story to get across because she's the one that's suffering today.
Yeah, Louise, let's go to Louise, because I suppose in a way, Louise, I don't want to put emotions in your mouth, so to speak, so you can outline it for us. But I mean, how is your experience any less than someone else's? I mean, you know, you've been through this, albeit as a baby, the same as everybody else has.
Yeah, I don't know how they're deciding who gets in and who don't and who doesn't. And I think that's one of my big problems with it. It seems like all the survivor groups, all the experts in early childhood development, all the psychologists, all the human rights people are saying it matters. And Minister O'Gorman has just decided it doesn't. So what my real question is what's he basing this on? I feel it's almost like a court case. The defense has said this is what we think is important, and I feel like he needs to come with his evidence from the other side of how he made this decision and why he thinks it's a valid decision.
Well, the only way you could understand this decision is because it's to limit the liability of the state. I mean, that's it. It's not about care. It's not about looking after. It can only be a financial decision.
Exactly. That's what it is, I guess. But, you know, he's not owning that. Of course, he's trying to come up with some nice story about how he's doing his best. But excluding people, it's re-traumatizing because most of survivors are often told in their lives, well, aren't you lucky you didn't end up here? And aren't you lucky you didn't end up being brought up by a teenage mother who didn't want you or whatever? And we can't play the what if game. We can't play the, well, what if, you know, mothers had support and they didn't have to give their kids up? Would we be better off or if this had happened or that had happened? But we can say that we do have harm from what did happen. And the government is responsible for that.
Yeah. And Esther, I mean, you're being re-traumatized by the very people we entrusted to try and maybe give you, I don't know the word closure, it's such a loose phrase, but whatever comfort maybe you might have gotten from this process, let it put it like that, the very people that we've charged to bring that to you are actually exacerbating your pain and your hurt and re-traumatising you.
Absolutely. Trust has been broken. There's no difference nowadays than it was in 1982, if not worse. Gone backwards. Re-traumatized? Yeah, re-traumatized because, you know, Louise just got a fraction of her information, birth tracing information, which he thinks is the greatest thing ever. Well, it's flawed because these adoptees are not getting all their information. In that information, she was missing for 3 weeks. We can't account for where she was for 3 weeks. Louise has some issues, and then she will talk about them. But I believe she was used in vaccine trials, unconsented vaccine trials, along with many, many, many other babies that were there.
Talk to me a bit about that, Louise. I think your mom wants the words to come from you.
I think, I don't know what happened to me in those 3 weeks. I don't know if there were trials or not, but even the fact of having a missing 3 weeks in your life raises anxiety. Anytime you have a health issue, you think, wait, did something happen that I don't know about? You know, so I don't know. I'm not accusing them of doing anything to me. I mean, somebody might say, oh, you were probably just where you were in a cot all the time being taken care of. That might be true. But the fact that adoptees don't know where they were, that's what causes them.
And I think it's very important for us who aren't affected by this to hear your words, right? Because I think unless you've been through this, people might go, well, what's she on about? And I mean that with absolute respect, Louise. I hope you understand my motivation for saying this the way I am. But this is ever present for you, this gap. And Esther's going to, it's going to be different from Esther than it's going to be for you because you're two individuals and you look at this in different ways and mom will have different concerns that maybe you will and vice versa. But if this were any of us, like we have to collectively try and imagine, put ourselves in your position, what we would be doing, we'd be screaming from the rooftops as well. And I think we just need to hear your words rather than just listen to them, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, this is something that's been with me my whole life. When I was a kid in school, you'd have school projects and you'd have to say, what time were you born or what weight were you where you were born? And I never knew that. And it was always a thing that would constantly come back that people would say, what were you like as a baby? And I'd say, well, I don't know.
And what's the first question you asked when you go into a doctor or a GP? The first question you ask,
Does it live in your family? That's what I had. I was diagnosed with a rare form of leukemia about 2.5 years ago. And when they were trying to figure out what it was all to do with, does this run in your family? Does that run in your family? Have you ever been exposed to this? Have you ever been exposed to that? And I just had to say, I don't know for most of the questions. And that's just appalling. And then, it really does a trick on your mind because you start thinking, well, was I exposed to something? Was I, you know, did something happen to me that I don't know about? So it's mostly the, you know, the kind of mental anguish that you go through. You're always missing information.
Can I ask you about that 3 weeks? Do you believe there is a gap in information or does somebody know and it's being withheld from you?
I think somebody knows. I just don't have it yet. For example, Esther left, when she left the home, she was told I would be handed over to my adoptive parents later that day. When my adoptive parents got me in November, which is about 3 weeks after Esther left, they were told I had been with her until a few hours earlier. So the fact that both sides, the fact that both parties were lied to makes me think, well,
what are you covering up? Yeah.
Yeah, I think the information is probably somewhere. I'm still waiting for my file from Tesla. So maybe it'll come out and it'll say that I was kept warm and cuddled all that time. That would be nice to know. But the fact that I don't know is enough of a worry at this point.
And Esther, unfortunately, you know, we're seeing it with some controversies over nursing homes at the moment, disability payments. There's echoes of redress schemes for defective concrete block homeowners, that if you announce something, you say it's great, and maybe, you know, the majority of people might get something from it, then that's the problem resolved. But there's a big group of people, 40% of people, 24,000 people, that are being treated very differently here. They're being told that they're not as important as other people. So we can't lose sight of the fact that this is actually inflicting more pain on a big group of people rather than maybe bringing that bit of closure or comfort to others, Esther. We don't want to live in a world like that. I don't want... I'm not being critical of a... It is a decision being made by a group of people primarily in Dublin, right? So maybe it sounds like I'm being anti them. That's my intention. I'm pro-people and I'm pro these people that are having their wounds reopened and having insult added on top of injury, Esther.
Yes, I agree with you, Greg. It's beyond belief. It really is. You couldn't make it up what they're proposing, what they're trying to do. And it is, unfortunately, for the majority of women like me, anonymity is a big thing. A lot of their families don't know they give babies up for adoption. A lot of adoptees don't know they're adopted. So anonymity is a big thing. They're not going to come forward and march the streets or go to Dublin and protest, you know, en masse. It's, you know, and the government, I think, know this. I think they're playing a game and they know this. I mean, we watched the doll and Roderick sat there on his own like a sacrificial lamb. Nobody there to back him up. Nobody. It just... Is this how government is? This is not the Ireland I know.
And I think there's a lot of very important words in the letter, the public open letter that you've released, but I think one which is actually really quite important. This did not happen in the Dark Ages. Talk to me about that point you're getting across there, Esther.
Because it's still happening. It's still happening. And this is not the Dark Ages. You know, we've come so far. Ireland has come so far. And it's always been open and you know, taking care of other people and think, you know, but they don't take care of their own. And this isn't, you know, like it isn't the Dark Ages. There is no excuse for this to be happening today.
And
you know, there's still nearly 900 babies buried in sewage tanks in Chum. And the religious orders, they're like, oh, well, we've sent them a letter, this and that. I have a letter here that came from the religious order saying they set up a meeting with the minister and his department. However, the department postponed the meeting and did not reschedule it. Mm. We're not getting any communication about why, when they're willing to meet with them, why they didn't meet, why they're not answering questions.
And
I guess that's the big thing. Yeah. Don't keep us in the dark. We're not stupid people.
Well, you see, and there's and Louise too, you know, we're quite rightly at the moment we're talking, and every issue seems to affect women, you know, all the big ones if you think about it.
Yeah.
And we talk about, you know, what we hope to do in the future and how this isn't. But what hope do young women have going forward as to how we will treat them if we can't fully take responsibility
for what we've done.
That's the point I'm trying to make. Like, really, what is this saying to young women and young men, but young women? Because all these things, for some strange reason, always seem to affect women mostly, don't they? But do you know what I mean?
Really, I don't think. I think we have a history of men running the world, so you know, I think it's not really that strange that most of the issues seem to affect women. And another point I'd just like to say is that it's really not about the money for me. I honestly, when there was talk of redress, when I joined the Oak consultation, I honestly never thought I would see a penny. And I was okay with that. I didn't, you know, I couldn't put a figure on it and say, oh, they need to give me this and that would give me closure. But then when I heard the proposal and it said, we're giving it to them, but we're not giving it to you, that really hurt. Like, it hurt my feelings. And I thought, well, why not? You know, it's not that I want the money, but it really did reinforce that idea that I have suffered nothing, according to them. They have done nothing wrong to me in their eyes.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what the point I want to make. It's not really about the money. It's about not excluding people.
No, and I think that I understand why you want to clarify that, but I think anyone listening to you and Esther will understand that that's clearly not the motivation. It's about whatever time we have left on this planet to have it in some level of sort of contentment or peace, or with questions answered. And money doesn't do that. Money doesn't answer the questions that you want answers to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Esther, is there anything else you want to add just before? And I think you might have had to get up quite early for us. I don't know, maybe you're an early riser anyway, but with this fantastic modern technology we have now, it's like you could be sitting beside each other, but you're not. You're speaking to us from New York, aren't you, Esther?
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? It really is.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you and for your support, and Carolyn for her support in this, because, you know, nobody really, I suppose, it's kind of an icky subject, if that's the right way to put it. People just don't know what to do with it. But if they hear the voices and see the faces behind it, I think every family in Ireland at some point has been touched by this issue.
Yeah, for sure. The open letter, it's called The Primal Wound. We might republish that on our socials so people can have a read of it and get an understanding of it. I could hear it in your voice, almost see it in your face, Esther. You know, what this insult to injury is how it's affecting you. So I do hope you get some comfort and peace soon, if that makes sense.
Thank you.
I'm not great with words sometimes, but I hope you understand the sentiment.
I know what you mean, Greg. Thank you.
You don't deserve it. Okay. And same to you. Louise, thank you as always for speaking to us, and I hope you get the answers that you deserve. This is your history, this is your past, you know, it's yours, it's no one else's, it's yours, and you deserve that. All right, thanks for your time again this morning. Take care of yourself.
Thank you.
All right, bye bye. God bless you. All right, take care. Right, today is Safer Internet Day. The theme of the event is hashtag Silent Witness Awareness, which will see students take the lead in promoting respect online. The campaign will also focus on online bullying, with advice being offered to young people as they manoeuvre the digital world. Philip Arneil is Head of Education with CyberSafe Kids. Good morning to you, Philip. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
I don't want to dilute the important issue, but, you know, we're the example to children, us as adults. And I just wonder if we've lost the plot on social media now. I mean, you know, how can we tell children not to do this, that and the other, or not to treat people one way or other, when there's so much hate, negativity, toxicity, division on social media amongst the teachers?
Well, I mean, I completely agree. I mean, I think it's essential, first of all, that adults model the behaviour they expect from children. And that doesn't just apply to social media or being online. It applies to things in general, of course. And we've launched a campaign today called Same Rules Apply to mark Safer Internet Day, which has exactly that message, which is that if you're behaving, you know, and you're raising children in the offline world, really in terms of digital parenting in the online world, the rules should be exactly the same. So, you know, you shouldn't be sending your kid off to the shop or off to the park, and you would never dream of letting them out there not knowing what they were doing. And so the same thing really applies to online behavior and online activity. Your children need to be supervised, you need to be having those conversations, and that's really very much the focus of our Same Rules Apply campaign.
I think sometimes it's overwhelming for parents and guardians where to start, because, you know, even having the conversation with a young person and then them pushing back, and do you know what I mean? It can be really, really difficult. Maybe for those who are bringing children through now, maybe it's slightly easier because you can set ground rules sort of from the beginning moving forward. But I think it's really tough for parents now of current 8 to 12 year olds, for example, to sort of say, actually, now these are a new set of rules.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we totally appreciate that. I mean, the reality is, you know, whether we like it or not, the digital world is here. There's great, there's lots of benefits and positive things about it. And so it is an important part of modern parenting. As part of this Same Rules Apply campaign, we've also, with in association with the Examiner, we have released a digital parenting booklet, which you can find on our website. And actually, it covers a lot of these issues. You know, it kind of demystifies a little bit some of these things for parents, because we understand it's overwhelming. We understand there's a lot. We understand that the online world moves quickly. But the reality is, you know, once again, in the offline world, you wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't hand your child car keys. You wouldn't say, you know, off you go and teach yourself to swim. And so when it comes to the online world, we just simply have to have these conversations. And yes, there will be pushback from children. You know, there's a lot of peer pressure. Well, my friends, my classmates have phones. You know, so-and-so is on this app, so-and-so is on that platform. But, you know, not having those conversations is not going to get you anywhere. So they can be tricky. They can be difficult. And I think this is why, you know, talking about the online world and making that a normal part of discussion within a family with your children is the first step. Because the more you do it, then the more normal it becomes. And then, of course, if obstacles do occur, problems do arise, then it's much easier to address those rather than perhaps them being hidden, or children or young people trying to deal with them themselves and not having the resilience or perhaps the experience to tackle those issues, and then, you know, the problem becoming worse.
The way I try to explain it is to treat the internet and in all of its guises, apps and everything, as a massive shopping centre in a strange city. And you don't drop your kids off at the door and say, you know, go and do whatever you want to do, nor would you allow your child to go up to a group of strange men, for example, and start hanging around with them, nor would you have them walk up to a group of teenagers and start calling them names, nor would you walk up to a girl and touch her inappropriately or say something inappropriate, do you know? And to try and use that maybe more relatable real-world space and how we behave and just treat it the exact same as you would the internet. They aren't, because as you say, it's part of our world now. So we have to view it like that. We do have to try and break it down in an understandable way, that there is a social discourse in real life. You would never dream of doing certain things. And those same rules apply in this digital space, rather than trying to get into every bloody app that's there, and online gaming and offline gaming and apps on the phone. Just try and break it down into that sort of simple premise for me anyway.
Absolutely, Greg. I mean, we should have had you on board, I think, for the campaign, because you've basically encapsulated what the message is, which is that the same rules do apply offline and online. And actually, apps will come and go. Platforms and popularity of games will change, but really the messaging is the same. You know, you wouldn't dream of doing these things offline. You would never allow children to do, or young people to do, certain things offline. And so when it comes to online, that same parenting, that same encouragement, that same supervision, that same monitoring is absolutely essential, because it is, and for many young people and children, online and offline worlds, they don't see this distinction that we, you know, we still talk about in the real world. But, you know, for a lot of children and young people, being online is part of their real world. And so it's really, really essential that we apply those same rules. We actually have released a video as part of this campaign, and it features a young boy who's online, he's up in his bedroom unsupervised, and then, of course, he's getting messages. Like any child, wants to make friends, wants to connect with people. Of course, he goes to the door and realizes that the people who are sending the messages are not actually the people they say they're online, say who they are online. And by that stage, of course, often with children and young people, it's too late. So, you know, we're saying, you know, if you wouldn't let your child walk up to a stranger in the park or in the street, and certainly not let them give them a photograph or an image of themselves, then, you know, why on earth would you allow them to do it online? So it's important to apply those same rules and to make sure that you're parenting exactly the same way in the online and the offline world.
You would hope that in that scenario I gave, the shopping centre scenario, if an adult come up to them and said something inappropriate, you would hope they'd tell you as soon as they run out the front doors. You have to set a space where they can do that without banning them then from the shopping centre. I mean, but I know I'm going on with this metaphor, but or if a group of lads or girls started pulling their hair or calling them names, you would expect them to relate that to you. And it's creating this sort of front door out of the online space that they feel they can say that to you without you necessarily withdrawing them from that altogether, because that's going to, the communication doors are going to come down. And also, Philip, you know, if you set up a new Android phone, I did so a couple of years ago. I'm sure it's the same with Apple. I mean, you can set it up Loctite in terms of when it can be used, when it can't be used, what apps can and can't be used, all password protected. If anything inappropriate's done, mom or dad or guardian get an email. You know, in terms of the technology there, we have the tools, but we don't employ them. I think maybe are we going to give up on that because that's not realistic? We just have to go with the education?
Yeah, I think it's everything really. So the education is absolutely key, and I agree with you. You know, banning is not really the way forward because, you know, if you go back, say, to the analogy of the car, it's often the car is the only way you can get to certain places. So saying, well, you know, people have accidents in cars, you can't drive one, just doesn't make any sense, right? And the same thing goes with a phone, you know, or a tablet or a games console. It's a part of life, and often it's a part of way of communicating. We saw that during the pandemic. You know, it was an essential way to for kids to attend school, to connect with friends and family. But, you know, there are technical restrictions. And again, in our digital parenting book, as part of this Same Rules Apply campaign, there's a lot of information in there. You know, you can go to those manufacturers' websites, you can find out how to lock down phones and make them safer. You can look also at apps and platforms. Their sites often have advice on how to change settings in order to make it safer for children if they're contacted or they get a follower request and that kind of thing. So I think it's really a bigger picture. It's education. It's also using those technical restrictions. And then, as you said at the start, it's also about us modeling the kind of behavior, you know, having perhaps zones in the house where phones or devices aren't used, have them charging in a communal area, have maybe times where there's a device-free time. And also then, even, you know, if you want to kind of establish like a family, online family agreement within the household where, you know, certain rules and norms are agreed by everyone, they're signed up to everyone. And let's face it, kids and young people, there's nothing they love more than correcting their parents and guardians. So, you know, again, if you're on your phone when you shouldn't be and you're caught out and you're told off, well, you know, you're bang to rights. Yeah. And again, you're modeling that positive behavior, and also then celebrating the positive benefits and great things that can come from being online, which we all know.
I do understand, you know, what to some extent what motivates people in society at the moment to behave and act and say what they do, and none of us are have a clear, you know, don't have any blots on our copybook. God, I haven't heard that phrase in about 30 years. But anyway, talk about an inappropriate one. We're talking about technology. But you just wonder, you know, the sponges, the 8 to 12-year-olds, 12 to 18-year-olds, when they see what's going on around the country and maybe don't understand precisely why it's happening. And I'm not talking about anything in specific. I'm not trying to attribute anything, by the way. I hope people understand. But if they do then wander onto the online space and see how us as adults are treating and speaking to each other, we all should put the children first and maybe just wonder what the consequences of that all could be. And I really want people to understand I'm not talking about anything specifically because it's across the board.
Yeah, I think this is probably the final piece of the puzzle as far as we're concerned. You know, on a societal level, we need this establishment of norms. You know, even something as simple as, you know, where you use devices. I lived in Japan for a long time. And, you know, if you get on a train there, no one takes calls. Everyone has their phone on silent. And there's kind of this etiquette that has developed with devices. And similarly, you know, in society,
we've got one carriage on the train from Cork to Dublin.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, the way that we talk to each other, the way that we interact online is really important. And so I think, you know, there's a couple of things there. We've got to remember things like YouTube, less than 20 years old. So we are always playing catch up. And if you think, you know, cars and those kind of vehicles were out there long before roads of the rules and things like seatbelts came along. But we've got to keep pushing for that. And one of the things that we advocate for with the government is stronger regulation of online service providers and social media platforms, because they've got to be held to account for the kind of things that are being allowed to be online. And also, we know from our own research, you know, that over 80% of 8 to 12 year olds already have social media accounts.
Yeah, but they're not supposed to have. You see, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, but you're not supposed to be on a lot of those sites till you're at least 13 years old.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we can always look to big brother or sister to sort of help us. But at the end of the day, you know, we're making these calls as parents. And when I say we, I mean actually me as well.
Yeah.
And finally, let's talk about the tools that are available, Philip, because, you know, like, if you can't, right, you can't help your child with their maths homework if you don't understand the maths. It's as clear as that. We've all done it. We've been talking about homework the last couple of weeks, right? They've got algebra, whatever it is. You know, you do the multiplication first and I haven't a clue, right? But I can't assist my child with their mathematics homework, if I don't have some grasp of maths, okay, we can't best protect our children unless we have some grasp of what apps they're using, what goes on in there, what to look out for, right? So that requires us to actually educate ourselves. There's no other way around it. It's impossible otherwise. What tools are available, for instance, from, and I mean, there's a lot out there, but from you guys, what's there to help us educate ourselves so we can help our kids?
Well, it's very simple. I mean, if you go to cybersafekids.ie/same rules apply, you'll find on there the video that I referenced. And also, as part of the Same Rules Apply campaign, a digital parenting booklet. It was designed with, in cooperation with the National Parents Council and the Examiner and supported by Accenture. And it's literally over 20 pages of resources for parents, because we understand parents are busy, parents are overwhelmed, but a lot of the resources are out there. And within that digital booklet, it's an interactive booklet, you can also download it. There are two pages at the back full of resources. So something like, for example, Peggy, which you can simply go to and find out anything you need to know about games that kids are playing. Something like commonsensemedia.org, we can also go and look up any of the apps. So, you know, there is a responsibility also for us as parents and adults to go and find out. And it's not that you have to be on TikTok. You don't have to be creating viral content on social media platforms. You just simply need to know, you know, what is the app? Why is it popular? What can I expect to find on there? And then what are the harms and risks? And of course, most importantly, what is the recommended age for that platform? So the resources are there. So I'd really recommend anyone listening to go to our website, cybersafekids.ie, look up that digital parenting booklet. And that's really the place to start. And it's a springboard to a lot of different resources that can help with that very thing.
And, you know, a lot of people think, and it's very important, we're always talking about bullying or boobs or bums or whatever it might be that children might be exposed to. But there is a worrying trend where, for instance, young impressionable people, particularly on TikTok in this instance, are taking their mental health advice from people on these platforms that don't have a background and have ulterior motives as well. So, you know what I mean? It's not just the obvious, you know, over 18 stuff as well. We have to make sure where they're getting their influences and if it's damaging to them as well. So that's really important that we really get as much information ourselves so we can help our young people. Philip, well done. Thanks so much indeed. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care of yourself. No, it's our pleasure. Philip R. Neal there, Head of Education with CyberSafe Kids. Right, okay. We are talking now to Avril Scally, Medical Negligence Solicitor at Lavelle Partners. I hope I have the correct pronunciation there. Avril, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Greg, and thank you for having me on your show this morning.
And it's on a serious matter because we're telling people that patients travelling to Turkey for cosmetic or medical procedures should check their contact, as they may not actually be covered in Ireland should a botched surgery occur. And this is really quite interesting because we've spoken to professionals in this part of the world recently, Avril, in the last couple of years, and an awful lot of their caseload is actually aftercare or repair following people having underwent some procedures in foreign countries such as Turkey.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, by way of background, I specialise in clinical negligence claims. So with the growing cosmetic industry, of course, I've seen a huge increasing number of cosmetic cases crossing my desk. And with that, obviously, some of the surgeries have been performed outside the jurisdiction. And unfortunately, as a solicitor here practicing in Ireland, I simply can't address those issues for those people. For example, if they're going to, as you stated, Turkey or anywhere outside the jurisdiction, the law that applies, the contracts are with the incorporated company in Turkey, and therefore they have to seek redress in Turkey. So that is a huge problem.
What are typical botched surgeries? Because it's sort of a catch-all, but what kind of cases have come across your desk?
Well, we see them from anything from dental procedures going wrong, gastric sleeve bands, breast implants. And I know there are particular surgeries that are, you know, getting more popular out there at the moment. But I just think cosmetic surgery is a huge growing industry with the there's certainly a need for tight regulation to ensure high standards. The number of clinics now providing cosmetic surgery services have grown considerably just to match the demand. An increasing number of non-professions are also training in and providing less invasive surgery. So we even see that in Ireland with Botox or any of the dermal, you know, anything to do with the skin. But these all carry considerable risks if not completed in a controlled manner.
So what? So if something goes wrong, if the surgery was done here, there's some recourse.
Yes.
Is it realistic to try and pursue a hospital, for example, in Turkey under Turkish law?
Well, absolutely. Turkey, of course, is outside. It's outside the EU. So we don't. I would say, to be honest, that there's very little redress for people trying to bring a claim in Turkey. I know probably the compensation levels, I have no idea what they are, but they may not be sufficient, even if you do bring a claim, to cover the cost of your treatment. Mm. So I think it's essential for anybody considering cosmetic surgery to research the reputation of the clinic and the surgeon undertaking the work. Prices should never take priority over experience, training and skill. You should look for an expert who specialises in the area of the body that you wish to have addressed. So another thing, really important thing, are those surgeons that are carrying out the procedures, are they insured? You know, there's a big difference between a dental practitioner, you know, in comparison to a dentist, or an orthodontist. So they're very specialised areas. So these, cosmetic surgeries are very lucrative. And some of the providers may not meet the clinical and care standards that are required, you know.
I know you're sort of more, you deal with people after the fact to some extent.
Yeah.
But is there any travel insurance or any type of insurance that you can get in advance that would cover these type of eventualities?
Certainly that I'm aware of.
I mean, why would a company indemnify surgeons in a foreign country? It wouldn't make any sense. I'm not surprised isn't.
Absolutely not. These contracts are performed outside the jurisdiction. So I suspect that they would need to check with their own insurers. Mm. But, you know, if these surgeries are available in Ireland, maybe they should be having the surgeries in Ireland, because obviously if things go wrong, it's going to be a lot more expensive because they require further surgeries that requires more recovery time.
And we should also, not to put fear into anyone either, but I mean, like the Department of Foreign Affairs, their official advice is to be cautious about travelling abroad for these types of procedures.
Absolutely, because I'm sure there's a recovery time. These are huge surgery, you know. There's nothing to be understated about it. They're big surgeries, and there's recovery time required. And the big issue I have with these is that there's no aftercare clinics in Ireland. So even if there's no negligence involved or the surgeon hasn't done something wrong, there's simply, you know, infections can happen. Yeah. Without there being any negligence, but they simply don't have the aftercare clinics here in Ireland to look after these patients.
Yeah, and as I say, you're actually echoing the words we've heard from people that work in this area within the public hospital system as well. Avril, listen, thanks for your time. People can get more information by Googling Lavelle Partners, I'm sure. Thanks for your time today.
Okay.
Take care of yourself. Great. Have a lovely Tuesday. Avril Scally there. Thank you very much for listening to the show. Great to have you on board. Thanks for all of you who got in contact as well. We'll be back with another programme for you, of course, tomorrow, Wednesday at 9 a.m. But for me, Greg Hughes, and Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show, have a wonderful Tuesday. Enjoy the bright weather.